establishment until the safety of Israel's northern residents is guaranteed, and under international humanitarian law, forced displacement is prohibited, and people should be allowed to return to their homes as soon as the hostilities cease or as soon as the conditions for their displacement cease to exist. But what we're seeing instead is that the return of people, and particularly of Shia residents in southern Lebanon, is being tied to some vague, undefined safety standard in northern Israel.
Ramzi Qais, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Lebanon researcher at Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Beirut, just back from southern Lebanon. Thank you so much. We will link to Human Rights Watch's reports. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for development associates. Support our fundraising team. Go to democracynow.org. And Democracy Now!, the film about it as we celebrate 30 years, is opening at the IFC Theater here in New York on Thursday. It's called Steal the Story, Please. I'll be doing the Q&A after the film with the film's directors, Carl Diehl and Tia Lesson, on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. It's also opening at the Jacob Burns Theater and at Huntington, where I'll be doing the Q&As there on Sunday and Tuesday. And then we head to Los Angeles to the Lemley Theaters in Glendale and North Hollywood and more, and to San Francisco at the Roxy and beyond. Check our website at democracynow.org for all details. The film Steal This Story, Please, and let your friends know. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Perptine, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Trina Nadara, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Love KBOO Community Radio and its mission? Step up and apply to join the board of directors. KBOO's board leads the station, shaping its future, representing member voices, safeguarding its financial health, and sustaining the independence of community radio. Every KBOO member can run for the board, and we especially encourage BIPOC members to apply. Want to learn more? Join an upcoming board information session held online via video conference from now through June. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/recruitment26.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Your KBOO Evening News is next.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Keith Wilson seeks homelessness funding from other counties.
Some 1,000 Multnomah County residents faced an eviction filing each month of last year.
And NASA astronauts slingshot around the far side of the moon.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 6th, 2026. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson wants Clackamas and Washington counties to help his homeless shelter shortfall. That's despite the fact that most of Portland is located in Multnomah County. Wilson's overnight shelter program was supported largely by one-time funds, so going into this next year, the budget year, there's a $15 million gap. Wilson has requested $6 million from Washington and Clackamas counties, which each cover a relatively small portion of Portland city limits. Wilson says the overnight shelters Portland offers are, quote, key emergency resources for these counties. Multnomah County is facing a serious budget shortfall, $87 million, with little money to spare for its own homeless service budget, let alone Wilson's. But this also comes as Wilson's relationship with the county appears frayed. He questioned the county's homelessness data without evidence in a public meeting, and county officials are on the defense. Washington County may offer at least $1 million. The commission is set to meet on the proposal on Tuesday. Multnomah Chair Jessica Vega Patterson questioned why Washington County has money to give out of the budget that each county gets from the Metro Regional Government Homeless Service funding. Vega Pedersen told Oregon Live, quote, Washington County's openness to redirecting funds is a clear signal that the current allocation model is out of sync with reality, end quote. She called for Metro's new oversight committee to reassess their model. Portland faces a $160.9 million budget deficit, officials say. Wilson will release his proposed budget on April 20th.
Around 1,000 Multnomah County residents faced eviction every month last year, new data shows. It's a slight uptick from years past. Most of these cases are for non-payment of rent. A vast majority don't end in actual eviction judgment. If the renter pays their back rent or agrees to move out, the case is dismissed. Eviction prevention programs have lost serious funding in recent years from the federal level, but state and local efforts have waned too. The U.S. Interagency on Homelessness found rent assistance and eviction prevention services are some of the most cost-effective ways to reduce homelessness. 92% of people who got eviction prevention help in Multnomah County in 2024 were still housed a year later. But the number of people in unsheltered homelessness jumped 40% over the last year in the county. Portland City Council is working on a plan to spend down $56 million that was found in the city's Housing Bureau. On Tuesday, the Housing and Permitting Committee will discuss a proposal to spend $9 million on rent assistance and nearly $2 million on an eviction defense program for renters. Council President Jamie Dumphy said in a statement, quote, while every level of government is slashing their budgets, these previously unbudgeted Housing Bureau funds are an opportunity to help those struggling the most with housing security. Healthcare and housing have a lot in common. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. The Housing and Permitting Committee meets on Tuesday at 2 p.m. in Council Chambers.
The astronauts on the Artemis II have ventured farther from Earth than anyone else in human history as of this afternoon. The spacecraft broke the record set by Apollo 13 in 1970 earlier today. It's been 5 days since the astronauts launched on April 1st. There are 3 American astronauts and 1 Canadian aboard. Their main task is to get a close-up look at the surface of the moon, and it's part of a long-term plan to return humans to the moon and eventually start a lunar settlement. The entire journey is live broadcast on YouTube. Here's an excerpt from the audio from that feed just minutes before the astronauts lost communication on the far side of the moon.
This is a live view from the Orion spacecraft. Currently aboard Orion, 4 crew members, Reed Wiseman, Victor Glover, Christina Cook, and Jeremy Hansen. And on the Earth, all of us, all of humanity. You can see the moon is starting to get a little bit dimmer as the astronauts are going to pass behind it. Now 6 minutes and 26 seconds away from that loss of signal. Again, we will be out of communication with them for about 40 minutes until they come around the other side of the moon and we can reestablish contact.
Integrity Houston, you are 6 minutes from your 40-minute lunar flyby LOS. From all of us, it's a privilege to witness you carrying the fire past our farthest reach. Thank you. Godspeed.
Thank you for that, Jenny. And thank you to all of you for allowing us the immense privilege to be on this journey together. It's quite amazing. And as we go on this journey, thinking about the NASA mission to explore the unknown in air and space, to innovate for the benefit of humanity and to inspire the world through discovery. And as you've gone along on this journey with us, hopefully we're doing just those things. And as we get close to the nearest point to the moon and farthest point from Earth, as we continue to unlock the mysteries of the cosmos, I would like to remind you of one of the most important mysteries there on Earth, and that's love. Christ said, in response to what was the greatest command, that it was to love God with all that you are. And he also, being a great teacher, said the second is equal to it, and that is to love your neighbor as yourself. And so, as we prepare to go out of radio communication, we're still able to feel your love from Earth and to all of you down there on Earth and around Earth. We love you from the moon.
Houston copies. We'll see you on the other side.
That was astronaut Victor Glover earlier this afternoon as the Artemis II flew around the dark side of the moon, the far side of the moon. The astronauts were cut off from communication with Earth for about 40 minutes. They are back in communication now.
Northwest Metals, a local scrapyard company in North Portland, faces hefty fines and contempt charges. The company repeatedly operated their recycling facility without proper permits and skirted environmental regulations. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality says Northwest Metals' unpermitted operation included processing discarded vehicles, fluids, lead acid batteries, and tires, and operating shredding equipment without permits. DEQ issued the company over $550,000 in fines, with $179,000 of fines due to what it calls the economic benefit of noncompliance. That's the money Northwest Metals may have saved by not paying for permits and other costs when it was required to comply. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield filed a motion earlier today to hold the president of Northwest Metals, Matoya Mo Anoda, in contempt for repeated environmental violations. Rayfield said in a statement, quote, "A court ordered him to follow the law, and he didn't. The people living near this operation deserve clean air, clean water, and a neighbor who follows the rules. And we are going to use every tool available to make sure that that happens," end quote. This DEQ penalty is just the latest in a long history of noncompliance dating back to March of 2018, when it was first cited for a large fire that broke out at its Killingsworth facility. That blaze spread throughout the scrapyard and burned tires, vehicle fluids, and plastics, and equipment. Smoke from that fire could be seen all over the Portland metro area. As a direct result of the 2018 fire, Portland Fire and Rescue ordered evacuations within a four-block radius and warned residents within a mile, and then expanded the evacuations after federal air monitoring found unhealthy conditions. DEQ's order requires Northwest Metals to take corrective steps, which were appealed by company president Anoda. The dispute is headed to a contested case hearing in July. DEQ public affairs specialist Michael Locke told the Portland Mercury, quote, "DEQ has the authority to consider Northwest Metals' past violations when making permitting decisions. Should Northwest Metals decide it wants to legally continue operations that require DEQ permits," Locke went on to say, quote, "the longer Northwest Metals operates illegally, the more severe civil penalties we can issue according to our enforcement guidance," end quote.
A new report shows the progress and opportunities with electric commercial vehicles and names Washington State as one of the top markets. Despite the loss of tax credits and other federal incentives, the report finds electrifying fleets is still cost-effective. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
The overall rate of electric vehicle sales may have slowed, but a new report shows companies in Washington and across the country are still transitioning to zero-emission fleet trucks, saying they're cost-effective and reduce hazardous diesel pollution. The report credits Washington State's incentives and proactive leadership for the state having one of the strongest commercial EV performances relative to its market size last year. Dakota Semler of Exos Trucks says range isn't as big an issue for electric fleet vehicles as people think, since most commercial vehicles like delivery and garbage trucks travel fewer than 200 miles per trip.
With the technology that exists today and has existed for several years now, you actually can electrify the vast majority of our commercial vehicle fleet in North America. And so that's what we set out to do.
Washington is launching a new $126 million incentive program called WASIP this month to help fleet operators switch to electric or hydrogen-fueled trucks. The goal is to cut diesel emissions by offering discounts to businesses willing to transition to cleaner vehicles. Semler notes his company now makes electric semi-trucks with nearly 450 miles of range, enough for regional shipping charging, if not yet coast to coast. Stefan Tonger is with Electrion, a company tackling the range challenge by creating wireless charging for EVs. He says policymakers need to reimagine how shared charging infrastructure works to eliminate range anxiety.
We just need to focus on the infrastructure barriers that are hindering scaling of these vehicles, because they are fun to drive and they are more efficient, they're cleaner.
The report finds electric trucks cheaper to operate and maintain, and that people say they enjoy driving them more than their diesel counterparts. Along with improving shared charging infrastructure, the report calls on states and industry leaders to focus on lowering costs with more incentives and backing new financing models to keep commercial EV deployment rolling. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Foreign policy experts say the Iran war isn't achieving its outlined goals. President Trump's 2027 budget proposal calls for a massive increase in defense spending, and farmers reel from USDA grant cuts. For that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Hey, how are you?
Iran continues to control Hormuz Strait, but beyond that, clearly has retaliatory capabilities, is able to hit back. And it does look like they are increasingly feeling like they are going to control the timeline.
Asla Aydin Tashbash with the Brookings Institution says the Iran war, now approaching a month and a half, has demonstrated America's military might, but she says the conflict's also spinning out of President Donald Trump's control. Trump continues to say Iran must make a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz under threat of retaliatory bombing of power plants and other civilian infrastructure. But Tehran continues to demand security guarantees and reparations, suggesting it's not about to back down. The U.S. was able to rescue an airman after Iran shot down two U.S. jets, demonstrating capabilities on both sides. The war is proving expensive, and the White House is asking for an unprecedented $1.5 trillion defense budget. The administration's spending outline also includes more cuts to safety net programs like Medicare and Medicaid. Healthcare organizations say clinics and hospitals are already closing or cutting staff in response to last year's budget mega bill. The administration also wants to cut more than $50 million from TSA and have some airports shift to privatized security. One Nevada TSA officer, speaking anonymously for fear of retaliation, says the cuts would be extremely short-sighted as the agency is already underfunded.
We need the money because our equipment is falling apart. We have metal detectors that are over 20 years old. We're working with equipment that's almost as old as some of the screeners that are working on it.
TSA staff are currently being paid through a presidential executive order, with the Homeland Security budget stalled over immigration enforcement rules. National farm groups are calling for reinstating grants that help small-scale farmers purchase land, almost $300 million, for projects in 40 states were terminated, with the USDA citing waste and discriminatory practices based on DEI. Jesse Gill with the Massachusetts-based nonprofit World Farmers says new farmers and immigrants need technical assistance and help getting capital, which will boost local food production and keep farmland from becoming developed as real estate.
We saw this program as a huge step in the right direction to really start to invest in farmers of different scale and really mobilizing and supporting them to grow.
Massachusetts is part of a multi-state lawsuit claiming the agency is imposing illegal conditions on the grants. A federal court has decided Trump isn't immune from civil claims relating to the January 6th insurrection. D.C. District Judge Amit Mehta ruled remarks by the president could be considered incitement, not protected by the First Amendment. Trump spoke at a Stop the Steal rally that day.
We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
Trump's legal team claims he was carrying out official duties as president and is therefore immune based on a controversial 2024 Supreme Court ruling. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 63. Today in history, in 1973, the American League of Major League Baseball begins using the designated hitter. The quote of the day is from Major League Baseball player Wes Westrum, who said, quote, "Baseball is like church. Many attend, but few understand."
Judge Sharon Gleason dismissed a federal class action lawsuit filed against the Alaska Office of Children's Services Tuesday. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. Judge Sharon Gleason dismissed a federal class action lawsuit filed against the Alaska Office of Children's Services last week. The lawsuit was brought by a national nonprofit working for foster care reforms. Attorneys for the organization alleged Alaska foster children are at risk of harm because of systematic problems that violated federal laws, including the Americans with Disabilities Act and federal child welfare protections. They pointed to high caseloads for caseworkers and an inadequate hiring and training process. About two-thirds of the kids in out-of-home care in the state are Alaska Native. But Gleason wrote that the attorneys didn't prove that any of the foster youth represented were actually harmed. Gleason also questioned the reliability of the evidence presented. Marcia Lowry is attorney and executive director of A Better Childhood, which brought the suit. She called the dismissal quite disappointing.
We did do a trial that involved a lot of evidence that I think was largely undisputed about how high the caseloads are in Alaska, about the lack of placement resources for children, about the failure to basically make attempts to remedy that situation.
She says a lot of children in Alaska are not getting benefits they're entitled to under federal law. Lowry says A Better Childhood is not sure yet of its next steps, but is considering an appeal.
We have seen dysfunctional child welfare systems really, really change and provide good services to kids, but we have seen that only as a result of litigation.
The Office of Children's Services declined an interview for the story. In a written statement, they said they're pleased with the court's decision and the verdict is an opportunity for the office to continue advancing its work. This story was provided by Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court spent 2 hours hearing a landmark case that could upend birthright citizenship. A 19th-century ruling on the citizenship of tribal members was at the heart of the Trump administration's defense. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrasio has this report.
This was the exchange during oral arguments when Justice Neil Gorsuch pressed Solicitor General John Sauer, who presented the government's case.
Yes, yes. So if a tribal Indian, for example, gives up allegiance to...
Born today, birthright citizens.
I think so, on our test. Yeah. If they're lawfully domiciled here.
Okay.
I have to think that through, but that's my reaction.
I'll take the yes. That's all right.
In an 1884 majority decision, the justices ruled John Elk, a Winnebago man living in Omaha, was not a U.S. citizen, in spite of the 14th Amendment codifying birthright citizenship.
My mother was probably not a United States citizen when she was born in 1923 in Oklahoma.
Bob Miller, who is Eastern Shawnee and with ASU's Indian Legal Clinic, has been teaching this very precedent of Elk versus Wilkins for 3 decades now.
I disagree completely with the argument that that's analogous to undocumented immigrants and them having children here.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrasio.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
April 15th is tax day, but the normal deadline has an asterisk this year. If you plan on mailing your taxes, the state of Oregon says you should put it in the mail no later than April 9th. That's because the U.S. Postal Service changed its rules about postmarking. Prior to this change late last year, letters and parcels were marked the day the post office received them. Now they're only postmarked when they reach a processing center, and there's only one in the state. In Portland, the State Department of Revenue recommends mailing your tax returns by Thursday or filing online. As an option, people can go to their local post office and request a worker manually postmark their envelope at the counter. 94% of taxpayers filed electronically in 2025, which often results in a faster refund.
Rural Americans will see increasing harms from the Save America Act due to its limitations on ballot box access. The legislation is one of many attempts by the Trump administration to limit voting access. President Donald Trump also implemented an executive order designed to heavily limit mail-in voting. Edwin J. Vieira has more on the story in New York.
Rural New Yorkers could face greater challenges to vote from the federal Save America Act. The bill requires voters to present a birth certificate or passport when voting, registering to vote, or updating their voter information. Data show most eligible voters, particularly in rural areas, don't have access to these documents. Michael Shimidis with Rural Democracy Initiative says some proposals create bureaucratic barriers to voting.
It would require things like you have to show your documents in person. And so that means that you have to be able to drive to the single location where you can show those documents. That could be an hour away and you have to drive during working business hours. So that means that you might have to take 2 or 3 hours off of work.
The bill comes amid a series of ways to suppress or dissuade people from voting in this year's midterm elections. President Donald Trump signed an executive order heavily restricting mail-in voting even after he voted by mail for a Florida special election. Not long after the executive order was approved, 23 states sued to block it. A Siena College poll finds most New Yorkers support voter ID laws, but other polls show many Americans don't support the Save Act, instead viewing it as voter suppression. Federal attacks on voting rights stem from disinformation by President Trump about most voting methods being rife with fraud, though studies show they're not. Shimidis says New York's voting system has various checks to reduce fraud while guaranteeing bipartisan collaboration.
The way that it works by law is there are election commissioners and staff from the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and then for every step of the process, there's members of both teams that approve every single step. There's no one party that can approve a process.
This means if someone registers to vote, members of both parties have to approve the person's paperwork. He adds there are processes to prosecute someone who votes when they're not supposed to. Shimidis feels the Save Act punishes everyone for the actions of the few. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
Family caregivers in Oregon provide more than $15 billion worth of unpaid care each year and are a crucial piece of the state's long-term care system, according to a new report from AARP. The report also finds that caregivers are continually faced with more complex medical tasks, such as giving injections and tracking medications. Isabel Charlet reports.
A new report highlights the value of the unpaid labor of Oregon's family caregivers based on local wages and care costs. The report from AARP called Valuing the Invaluable estimates family caregivers in Oregon provide unpaid care worth more than $15 billion each year. Michael Schultz with AARP Oregon says about 740,000 Oregonians care for an aging loved one, assisting with everything from rides to appointments to complex medical tasks like injections.
People should really recognize that if we didn't have people stepping up to be family caregivers, the long-term care system in the state would just implode. There's no way that there's enough resources, private or federal, to fill that gap.
Schultz says nationally, family caregivers provide $1 trillion of unpaid care per year. That amount is more than federal, state, and local Medicaid spending combined. AARP adds that without caregivers, many more Oregonians would need to pay for in-home care or institutional care, which would increase expenses for families, taxpayers, and public programs. Schultz praises Oregon for having many informational resources available for caregivers. He highlights Oregon's Project Independence, which is based on Medicaid eligibility.
But there's a lot of people that just fall into that in-between zone where they don't qualify for that based on income, but yet the need is still there.
Schultz says many caregivers are forced to work fewer hours or leave their jobs entirely to take care of their loved ones and thinks the state could do more to support them. He says caregivers need adult day services, more training, paid leave, and workplace flexibility. On a federal level, Schultz supports the Credit for Caring Act. The legislation would allow eligible unpaid family caregivers to recoup up to $5,000 in tax credits for care-related expenses. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
A new study from the University of California, Riverside, finds that while the anaerobic digesters designed to capture methane from cattle waste on dairy farms are effective, any leaks can release huge amounts of the potent greenhouse gas. Suzanne Potter has more on that story.
Cattle on California dairy farms produce huge amounts of manure, which releases methane gas into the atmosphere. Now a new study looks at leaks in the digester systems meant to capture and repurpose that gas. Researchers from the University of California, Riverside find that digester systems capture methane effectively but must be monitored for leaks because even temporary failures can release massive amounts of the potent greenhouse gas. Study author and UCR climate scientist Alyssa Valdez says when a digester covers a waste lagoon, it acts like a giant balloon.
It does a great job of capturing all of that methane, but when it leaks, you might see more methane than you accounted for. And those leaks, unwatched and unregulated, can pose a real large problem.
The digesters are designed to funnel the captured methane into natural gas pipelines. Researchers analyzed 8 years of satellite data and airborne observations from 98 dairies across the state. In some cases, they observed point source methane emissions leaking from digesters at 1,000 kilograms per hour, which is more than 90% higher than the typical rate of emissions from an open-air manure lagoon. The California dairy industry reports 243 dairy digester projects in the state, with about a third of them still in development. Valdez says although leaks are rare, the fight against climate change means methane releases must be minimized.
It's 80 times stronger than carbon dioxide, so we don't want to create large emissions of it into our air.
The study recommends that going forward, aerial observation should be combined with on-the-ground measurements to make sure digester systems are in good working order. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, April 6, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production for tonight's newscast are Althea Billings and Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Jill Freitas, Isabel Charlet, Edward J. Vieira, and Suzanne Potter. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support